You had an edger and a trimmer in the planing mill down here?
No, the trimmers and edgers are just in the sawmill. They had all been taken care of.
Mm-hmm. So you had just a big band saw, a big circular saw, and a planer?
No, the circular saw was just a cutoff saw, and it was a smaller one, maybe 14 inches to 16 inches, just if they needed to lay it on here and cut to a different length, or if something came in that wasn't trimmed, it might come in and hadn't been trimmed somewhere else, another mill, and then it could be cut off before it was run through the planer. And so in the planing mill, it was just the planer and a little rip saw, cut-off saw, and the band saw.
Mm-hmm. And the band saw made flooring?
The band saw, no. If, for instance, if you had 4x8 plank, and you wanted it made into a 2x8, we could rip it right in the center, mm-hmm. send it through.
What was the machine that made flooring?
That was it would be a planer. It was set. We could make flooring see on airplane because it planes and mats. And it would be set, for instance, you wanted 2 1/4 inch flooring today, it would be set for that. Now, they used to make, not now on account of labor, they used to make flooring down to an inch and a quarter wide. And but there's 2 1/4 and 3 1/4 now that they make it.
What were the chief kinds of wood used for flooring?
Here was birch and maple, and then we bought from the west oak. They, of course, they would make some spruce flooring for porch floors here, and then we'd buy some fir flooring for porch floors. Fir was very good for outside. Hardwood isn't good for outside because it rots out quickly. It's just good for interior flooring.
You wouldn't think hardwood would rot faster than and softwood, would you?
It does, a great deal.
I wonder why.
There's something about the fungus and bacteria that work in it, and it rots three or four times as fast as softwood. And hemlock is much better than spruce. Hemlock and fir don't rot, or cypress, for instance, or redwood. Those are the ones that don't rot in moisture. Up here, it's moisture that seems to work through and get them. When we piled our lumber out to dry, it should dry a year unless there was a kiln. Down here we didn't have a kiln. It was piled out and each course was spaced so that the air would go through and keep it dried up. If it were piled together, it would immediately mold and ruin the boards.
So you had to pile them sort of like bricks?
Yeah. Uh-huh. We had many railroad ties, and there'd be three of them. You couldn't have too many, or you'd get a place that would show mold or black and undone. And there'd be, say, 3 railroad ties spaced from 4 feet apart, maybe. And then the lumber would be piled even in front and let the longer ends go to the back so that it would look well. And then every pile, there would be a couple stickers, as we called them. There'd be 3 of those, so that to let the air go through each course.
What was a course? What's this thing you call a course?
What would the what?
The course be. What is a course?
Oh, I beg your pardon. Yes, I didn't realize what you were saying. I heard you, but each pile was, we'll say, about 12 feet wide in front, and maybe 12 feet high. And each single layer of boards that went the 12 feet, which were also spaced about an inch apart, made up a course of lumber that went across.
Mm-hmm. What saw made clapboards?
The bandsaw. They would be planed boards, and we take them out of 1 1/4 or 5 1/4 as we called it, and then that would run through the bandsaw and make your clapboards. And that would take out for the saw and still leave them half inch thick.
Mm-hmm. So the bandsaw would cut the 1 1/4 right in half, mm-hmm. to make clapboards.
Mm-hmm. It would be tilted, you see. The bandsaw could tilt. Could go straight or tilted any way you wanted.
What was the best wood for clapboards?
In this country, they use spruce, but the best ones that we would get from the West would be cedar. Spruce checked a little faster, and the knots were a different type. It wasn't quite as good. Spruce clapboards were used a great deal on many barns, but it would check out much quicker than red cedar.
What do you mean, check?
It was split open with a fine hairline. Yeah, so that even if it were painted, the paint didn't entirely fill it.
Did you use much native cedar from right around here?
There wasn't much that was large enough to use. Most of the cedar around here was used for cedar posts, but they used to, on a farm, use a great many.
Mm. What types of services did the yard supply, like cutting boards to specification and selling nails and building supplies and things like that?
Mm-hmm. We did that for farmers who brought in their own. And it was usually sod. I mean, I remember later, probably earlier was much less, but about $18 a thousand was charged for sawing. And then it would depend upon how wide the boards were for the planing. For instance, you could put a board that was 12 inches wide, which would be 12 feet. It would be planed by the thousand through just as fast. You could put down a 4-inch. So it would cost less to run wide boards through than it would narrow.
You would cut to any length and width of a man wanted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Would you do any elaborate cutting?
Well, we used to make door sills and other things in our shop. Like on our joinder, they would make door sills, which have to be rabbeted out and then beveled. And other things that, quite a bit, that could be done on a small saw, joinder, and mortar stone like that. They could, for instance, make window parts of windows, the rails and so forth for an entire window, and the mullion like that. Only we didn't. The later years, because making it piece by piece costs a lot more in time than it would to buy the things where they were made in large quantities.
Mm. Did you do the fancy scroll work for porches?
Well, on the little bandsaw, they would do that in the shop. Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, they could do almost anything like that you wanted.
The little all these small saws were in the shop.
Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. What were the saws in the shop? You had a bandsaw?
Yes, there was a small bandsaw. Now, the bandsaws at the planing mill are about 6 inches wide.
Mm-hmm.
And the bandsaw in the shop, most of them were half inch to an inch. And with a half inch bandsaw, you can move your piece of lumber. And that, so that it can cut in shorter circles and so forth, you can handle it where you couldn't, a big one.
Mm-hmm. And what other saws were in the shop?
We had the rip saw and the mortiser and the
joinder. What's a rip saw like?
Rip saw is one that on a table that comes up and it works up and down. You can move the table up and down. And you can also move the side so that you can make it an inch or go up to 20 inches. You move this guide back and forth on the rip saw so that you can do any width you want. And you can also tilt it to bevel. It tilts. And then the little joinder, you can move that so that you can rabbet out. If you wanted a piece of lumber rabbeted 4 inches and it was 6 inches wide, you set your rabbet here and you ran it along and it just rabbeted out the part that was over the saw that turned.
What is rabbeted? What does rabbeted mean?
Taking it out. For instance, if you had a 2x4 and you wanted to rabbet it half by two on that part, this joinder just gouges out that one perfect part, only it's done perfectly. I mean, it's smooth with a planer edge. Then you could slide it, if you wanted something to be even here, but to slide over and stop when it got there, it could be rabbeted out.
So rabbiting is cutting, but cutting so that all the four sides or six sides are smooth. It must have taken a rather complex saw to do that.
Yes, it's the handling. The saw runs on a roller here. And then you raise, with your wheels, you raise the saw up and down. And this part of the joinder is perfectly smooth. Or if this is raised up, it takes out more as it goes along. If it's lowered, that's different.
And what were the other saws in the shop?
In the shop? Just cut-off saws, more or less. If you had, for instance, if you wanted, and the panel saw, if you wanted a sheet of plywood cut, and the plywood is 4x8, I mean, it's a standard size, and you put it up on the panel saw, then it cut 4x6, you just pull the panel saw down, and it cut it entirely through. Where if you were trying to handle it on a flat saw, it's hard to reach, but the panel saw was ran vertically instead of horizontally. And then the cutoff saws, you might have a piece of hardwood that you wanted 4'6" long and it was brought in 6 feet long. So they cut off 1'6", you know, on one of the cutoff saws. And it depends upon which one, the size of the hardwood. Certain saws could handle a small piece, but they couldn't handle a big, thick piece because they'd bind and hurt people. They could break you.
Mm-hmm. Who were the men who worked in the shop?
Well, the last two that we had were Dolph Oakes and Melvin Martin. Melvin Martin was an electrician and mechanic of every kind, a super mechanic. And Dolph Oakes was a former carpenter and a shop man. Very good. They were both in the shop. Mm-hmm. And then Earl Eggleston was there at times, too. He was from South Bangor, formerly from Scary.
So who were the early men in the shop?
Who were the what?
The early men.
Early men?
In the early days.
The shop wasn't built till 1946. And so I think that Dolph and later Melvin were the ones. We had an Ed Lapine who ran our boiler and so forth, but he wasn't a shop man. He was the uncle of Ed Lapine who takes care of the Morningside Cemetery now.
Did you sell nails and building supplies in the early days?
In those days, the nails and so forth were right. What was part of our front office now. Well, you went through some of the nail room before you got to the little office in the back. Most everything in those days, people didn't have cars and so forth, so there were customers usually called, you know. There wasn't much to, they didn't come and look at it like customers did later when they had the means of getting around. And there wasn't the different paneling and as many different things. There are more or less bread and butter items. They knew what they were, so they just call up and order them, and you'd send them out to them. I think that after people in the toll, we'll say in about 20, before 26, we changed it over, I think, very much in 26 to have the front office and to have people so that they could come in and sit down. And you could show them items, you know, and also you kept getting a better display room because there were more things to show. They didn't know what everything was the way that it used to.
Mm-hmm. What was in the early shop, in the early supply room?
Well, and we always, when we had hardwood flooring, we always kept hardwood flooring in where it was warm so that if you wanted to lay a floor in your living room, we could send it out and you could lay it that day. Otherwise, if it was piled out in an open storehouse where they wasn't heated, it would acquire a certain amount of moisture and had to be kept in your living room for a few days again to get that moisture out, or it would shrink when it was laid. So that we had a lot of nails and things, small items that could be put up easily there, and hardwood flooring, I remember, in the office. At that time, then everything else was out in the sheds.
The flooring was the only kind of wood you kept in the office.
Mm-hmm. At that time.
You must have had quite a big office to hold it.
Yes. It was the former Express Company, and it was 38 feet wide, and it was 40 feet deep, and it was two-story.
This was your office?
Mm-hmm. No, that was the whole building. I mean, the storeroom for the flooring and so forth. The furnace was in the room for the flooring. It was on the floor level at that time, instead of being in the cellar.
I see. What was the most expensive flooring for a person to buy?
Oak was more expensive than our birch and hardwood that we bought. We bought most of our birch and maple too, because it was made at big flooring mills and it could be bought cheap and you could manufacture it. Mm. Oak was a little bit more because it came farther out west.
For a 9x12 room, how much would it cost to floor it?
At that time, in the early stages, it would be about $30. No, it would be, for a 9x12 room, it would be $65 to $70. Mm-hmm. Now, nearly all flooring is sent already finished. It's cheaper to buy it already finished than unfinished. That seems funny, doesn't it? But they do it now at the larger mills because there's so much more call for it, that it's cheaper for you to buy it already finished. It makes a much better floor. Don't have to sand it after you put it down.
Did you charge by the board on
uh-huh.
the floor?
Uh-huh. Well, no, when I said by the board, it does go by the board, but there are bundles of flooring, and there's so many pieces that usually each bundle is marked like 8 square feet, and the old flooring is 8 square feet in a bundle. And so each bundle goes out. Of course, they can be broken if you just needed some that needed 2 extra feet or something, but they're marked in the bundles because it's much faster handling it.
When did the mill start building porches or building steps and doing work like that?
In 1946.
When you got the shop?
When they had the shop. See, the shop was heated so that you could do anything inside in the winter when carpenters couldn't, be too cold for them to work outside.
But you didn't make any steps or do anything like that before 46.
Oh yes, they probably made them there. Only I meant it was done on a more universal scale there after we had the shop. Mm-hmm. Usually before that, carpenters would order your 2x4s and your 5/4 and make it on the job. But it was much faster. They can make them cheaper in a shop because you had all the material right there. And the floor was level and was cut off saws and all. You didn't have to do things by hand.
So the two men who worked in the shop would make porch steps and would make filigree work for a porch.
Uh-huh, things like that.
Mm-hmm. When did you start selling paint?
When did we what?
Start selling paint and varnish and things like that.
I would say that it was around in the 30s, around there, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere. We did a great deal more after 1926. When Dad had the sole ownership, you can make up your mind easier than if you're a partner. I mean, you know, if you're in partnership, you're always referring to each other, and this takes a little more. Well, you want to make certain that you're going to make money and not have your partner criticize, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm. What was the most expensive lumber altogether to buy?
I would think that about the most expensive would be flooring at that time. Mm-hmm. That would be the one thing that would inside trim. would be on a comparable basis, only there was less of it. And as lumber kept going up, the casings and baseboards and moldings, they kept getting them narrower so that the cost was less. And they found that they were better looking narrower anyway after they once got them to making them narrower. They were less conspicuous and didn't stand out in the room.
The molding you see on the baseboard there.
Now that's a baseboard molding on top. Mm. That's the baseboard, the flat board, and then down at the bottom is a carpet strip.
Mm-hmm. Did you do that molding in the shop?
We could. Uh-huh. We didn't, as a usual thing, because we could buy it cheaper and we could make it.
Right.
But you might have to have a piece that had to be made to match, because you had put in a piece of furniture and, or took out one, and the next piece you put in needed a little, maybe 3 or 4 foot piece, and then you'd make them to match so that they wouldn't have to take it all off.
What saw would be used for that kind of operation?
On those, you would use the rip saw a great deal and raise it and lower it and cut it just to make it, and then after it was done, you would sand it. We had little sanding machines, and of course it'd have to be some by hand to get out the grooves just right.
Hmm. Did the yard give credit?
Did
the mill yard give credit to people who couldn't afford to pay cash?
Oh yes, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Woe be on it. Which is a bad thing to do, isn't it? The collections and anything like a mill or company like that take valuable time that they shouldn't, you know, that you have to... people don't always keep their word. I mean, they would get credit and to pay at a certain time it would be made out, and then they wouldn't... You'd have to go to them always. And then also you might have to take a note, and each time the note is renewed, instead of... I mean, I don't mean everybody. I mean, there are always some who let you chase them rather than coming as they promised.
Hmm. Were you giving credit in 1918 and 1926?
We went on a cash basis, and I've forgotten. It seems like it was around 1956 or sometime along that. We went on, we called it an entirely cash basis, but even then, you don't, because you would come down and you would forget your checkbook, and you'd be a good customer, and we'd send it to you, of course. And then, seeing you'd forgotten it, it might be 10 days before you'd get it there. It wasn't as important to you as it was to us, you know, after they had the material. But, yeah, it was very, very little loss compared to the percentage you lose when you charge. And then, of course, in the last 10 years, the credit cards issued by Marine Midland and other companies have helped a great deal, because if people couldn't get credit established so they had a credit card with them, you preferred to have them buy elsewhere too. See what I mean? If you needed credit and didn't have credit with the bank, the lumber company didn't really need you either.
Did you have many bad debts?
Always. Uh-huh, some. They say that if a debt goes longer than 30 days, that you'll lose 20% of any amount that you have after that, which is bad. When you're making maybe a net of 6% or down to even 1 and 2%, it's bad.
Why do they say you lose 20% after 30 days?
When you have to give, for instance, if anybody hasn't taken care of it, then it drags and they try to get out of it. They've had the use of the material. And so this always is saying not everybody, it's always saying a special few. They've had it and they don't mind if you have to chase them. They've been using it, and their word doesn't mean as much to them as it does to other people. So that if you finally have to put a collect in a collector's hand, you've sent out a good many bills and notices, and you maybe have seen them personally. And then finally, and a collector's. Now a collector's is 33 and a third. So it doesn't pay to charge.
Were there any outstanding bad debts, an enormous amount, a very large amount?
Well, no. Any amount, I mean, like sometimes you'd lose, maybe you'd have a $900 one, or maybe you'd even have, we've even had checks given to us up to $1,000 or maybe $2,000 that you had thought they were perfectly good at that time, and then find that they'd issued so many that it wouldn't do you any good to try to collect it by law. They were so deeply in debt that they couldn't. And maybe it would be somebody who was using an account and had a large amount all the time, so that they always owed but were paying all the time, then all of a sudden they went bad. They had gotten involved so deeply that you might lose $30,000. You tried not to.
But you would give credit to anyone who came in the first time?
Oh, no. Oh, no. We looked them up. Oh, yes, we didn't. Didn't plan, no. We didn't plan to be caught. We tried to be very careful.
Mm-hmm. Were the best customers small customers in great quantity or big concerns that would order a large amount of money?
Well, the big concerns were usually very good. And many times, some of the best customers wouldn't necessarily be worth the most. Some of the larger ones might be more careless. Not that they weren't going to pay their bill, but for instance, if you gave discount 5% discount in 10 days, they might let it go a day or two and still try to take the discount because they know you'd hate to hurt their feelings. You know what I mean? But a little customer maybe who lived down on Lower Park Street or something, and he might be as good as gold. He might not have many earthly possessions, but his word was so good that he would be trusted for anything. That you'd know that if he told you a certain thing, it was, or she, it was right.
Did your father travel to solicit business?
You mean for the business?
Yeah.
Well, for instance, if somebody called up and they needed to have a barn figured, if they need, then so he went out and figured it for them. That was all gratis work too.
It was free?
Uh-huh. Yes, funny, in those days, your time, you just gave it more freely, I think, than they do now.
It wasn't free in the later years of the mill.
You went, pardon?
It wasn't free in the later years of the mill, the estimate.
No.
No. When did your father stop doing free estimates?
Oh, well, you didn't stop, really. If you were going to build a house, you weren't, and you wanted it figured, a certain house figured, we always figured it for you, free. Because you wanted the business, and you did that to help yourself get the business.
Did he ever go to large concerns outside of the state and present the quality of his lumber and ask them to buy a certain amount?
Well, not too much. You mean where we were selling it out to large concerns? Well, do you mean like if a contractor came to build the high school or something like that? Then we always went to see them and showed them and tried to bring them to the office and mill to show them.
Well, he wouldn't travel way out of his way and just tell people who he was and where he was from and that he had...
Not a great deal, no. We advertised, but your time was taking up quite a little bit. You didn't have too much time.
How would you advertise?
The papers and also on the radio when it came here. See, there are small papers like Chateauguay Record and Fort Cobb and Sun and other places around within a 40-mile radius, usually. That's what you plan to take care of.
Mm-hmm. Did you have slogans, or did you just have a simple?
Yes, I know that for years we always had that. the Bourne Lumber Company, we treat you right. Was one of the slogans and things like that.
Who thought that up, your father or somebody?
I can't remember. It might have been my brother. It seems as if it was my brother that thought it up, and then we used it on our letterheads and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Did the yard operate at night after dark?
At one time decided to close on Saturday, which was a very good business day, but we wanted to have more time, and so we opened on Thursday nights, and that was the night before the stores were open, so that people wouldn't be staying uptown rather than coming to our place, and it worked out very well. Of course, it was slow at first. People would forget. We'd have to run down on a special trip for them Saturday if they caught us, but our Thursday night opening was very good, and it gave us a better weekend.
Did the saws at the mill work at night?
No.
No.
Never worked at night.
What time did they start working in the morning?
Earlier. I think it always was 8 till 6, and then 8 till 5. In the very, very early years, I think they worked till 6, from 8 to 6. But then, of course, afterwards it was 8 to 5.
How often did you get shipments of lumber in?
It would just depend. Of course, they wouldn't come regularly. You'd have them ordered. Usually you have to order lumber from the West Coast a couple months ahead at least. And so if you had 5 carloads coming in, invariably 2 or 3 would come at the same time rather than be spaced out, all different companies and everywhere.
What was the chief wood you got from the West Coast?
What
was the main kind of wood you got from the West Coast?
Pine from the West Coast. And then Western Canada, we did get quite a lot of spruce afterwards. But Eastern Canada...